wait for time to pass. Prior studies, done with one of the species of coronavirus that causes the common cold and with SARS-1, have shown that the initial antibody response wanes with time, lasting about a year, but that people nevertheless still retained potent memory immunity based on memory T cells. Another crucial factor is safety. The usual rate of serious complications for approved human vaccines is approximately 1 out of 1 million recipients. The seasonal flu vaccine might kill 1 out of 10 million people to whom it is given, a figure that is clearly offset by the thousands of lives saved annually by the vaccine. But no matter how many lives a vaccine saves, safety is a serious issue, especially in some populations, like children, who face relatively less risk of getting or succumbing to COVID-19. Some vaccine candidates for other coronaviruses actually made the infection worse in animal testing, in part by worsening the natural way the animal's body attempted to fight off the infection. Another risk is that if the wrong kind of immune response is elicited, the body might attack itself in what is known as an autoimmune reaction. This happened with the flu vaccine in 1976, when many patients developed a kind of paralysis from which most people recovered, known as Guillain-Barré syndrome. Rushing to bring a vaccine to market could also cause other sorts of safety problems in its manufacturing. Infamously, this happened in the Qatar incident during the early launch of the polio vaccine in 1955. When the polio vaccine was made available, mass vaccination days were organized by local communities. More than 120,000 children received a batch of the vaccine in which the process of inactivating the live virus was incomplete. Within days, there were reports of children developing paralysis, and the mass immunization program was abandoned within a month. Investigations showed that 2 batches of the vaccine, manufactured by Qatar laboratories, had the live virus, resulting in symptoms in 40,000 people, permanent paralysis in 51, and death in 5, and this does not include cases of the virus spreading to other children. This episode was described as a perfect storm of sloppy company practices, greed, and lax federal oversight, leading to a tragedy for the victims. It's hard to move with both speed and prudence. A survey in May 2020 revealed that 73% of Americans were confident a vaccine would be developed. Still, 64% said that scientists and companies should take the time they need to ensure that pharmaceuticals are safe. But in the rush to develop a COVID-19 vaccine, some pharmaceutical companies are skipping some crucial steps, such as trials in animals, and neglecting needed preliminary work in small groups of humans, which might adversely affect the safety of the resulting vaccine. I am concerned that a vaccine that seems safe in trials will be revealed to have problems when administered to millions of people. Any adverse reactions are sure to be breathlessly covered by the media, reducing public interest in vaccination when it is most needed. Another unusual step taken to accelerate availability is the construction of manufacturing facilities even before a vaccine is proven effective or approved. Philanthropist Bill Gates has said that he would financially support, at tremendous cost, the construction of 7 different factories using different manufacturing methods in advance of knowing which vaccines might work. Similarly, drug companies have indicated that they are ramping up production capabilities even before knowing if their candidate vaccines are effective. There is much to worry about in the development of a COVID-19 vaccine. This is a new virus for which new vaccine approaches are being attempted, requiring novel manufacturing procedures as well. However, we could wind up with more than one type of vaccine in the end, and some types may be more or less suitable for particular populations, such as children, the elderly, the immunocompromised, and so on. No matter when a safe and effective vaccine appears, it will help to prevent deaths from COVID-19. The efforts to find drugs that can treat COVID-19 have proceeded with similar levels of international cooperation, speed, and ingenuity. Within a few months of the onset of the epidemic, dozens of chemicals were being repurposed or proposed as treatments for the virus. Clinical trials were launched, often reflecting partnerships between pharmaceutical companies, universities, governments, and even international bodies such as the World Health Organization. For example, in March 2020, the WHO initiated what it called the Solidarity Trial in 10 countries, enrolling thousands of patients infected with SARS-2 to explore the potential utility of 4 existing antiviral medications previously used for other viruses. The variety of drugs studied has been impressive, ranging from hydroxychloroquine, which we discussed in Chapter 4, to an antiviral medication known as remdesivir that inhibits RNA synthesis, to other medications acting in biochemically ingenious ways, such as favipiravir or lopinavir, to various human monoclonal antibodies, to steroids, and many other drugs and approaches. An important trial from remdesivir appeared in May 2020 and showed that the drug could decrease the amount of time patients spent in intensive care by a few days. To be clear, this was a modest outcome and applied only to severely ill patients. The investigators were not able to show that the drug could prevent death, regardless of its impact on hospitalization duration. Nor were they trying to show that the drug could prevent progression to serious disease among the much larger population of infected but not sick people. But still, even if it did not ultimately prove to have those other beneficial effects, the drug could have other benefits for our society. Freeing up ICU capacity is a crucial objective. On June 16, 2020, it was announced that a steroid known as dexamethasone could actually reduce mortality in hospitalized patients. The announcement came via a press release from Oxford University. A scientific paper followed a couple of weeks later, indicating how important the investigators felt it was to rapidly, publicly share the information. Dexamethasone is very inexpensive and widely available. It was discovered in 1957 as part of work conducted by Philip Showalter Hench on the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. Steroids as a class, and dexamethasone in particular, suppress the immune system, which appeared to provide relief for patients whose lungs were ravaged by the overactive immune response that sometimes arises later in the course in severe cases of COVID-19. But patients still need functioning immune systems to fend off the virus itself. This is a tricky balance. The proper moment to use the drug may depend on the course of illness in particular patients. In the trial, a total of 2,104 patients were randomized to receive dexamethasone for 10 days, and they were compared to 4,321 patients who got usual care. Overall, the drug reduced the 28-day mortality rate by 17%. This large reduction in mortality was welcome news. But the drug showed the greatest benefit among those sicker patients requiring intubation. Indeed, there was a hint in the findings that the patients who did not require ventilators might have done slightly worse on the drug, perhaps by interfering with the ability of the immune system to ward off the virus. Developing, testing, and deploying drugs is not easy. Still, the emergence of drugs, such as remdesivir and dexamethasone, and others to come, vindicated the whole strategy of deploying the non-pharmaceutical interventions to flatten the curve. By buying time, we allowed ourselves the opportunity to use our capacities for teaching and learning in order to enhance our survival. One classic study of immunity and symptoms related to coronavirus, involving the 229E strain, which causes the common cold, published in 1990, involved an odd twist. 15 volunteers were deliberately infected with the virus. They all went on to develop cold symptoms, and the amount of circulating antibodies in their blood was periodically monitored for a year, at which point the levels were observed to be very low. But had their immunity waned completely, or did they have some memory immunity? There was only one way to know for sure. 9 of the 15 volunteers agreed to be challenged, that is, they went back to the lab to be deliberately reinfected with the virus. Although their antibody titers were extremely low or undetectable at the time, they indeed still had some immunity, since only 6 of the 9 became reinfected with the virus, and none developed symptoms. Vaccine and drug development is usually extraordinarily laborious. The process costs around $1 billion from start to finish, and it typically takes 10 years. Even in late stages of drug development, when human trials have already begun and people are excited about the promise of the drug being evaluated, it is not uncommon for toxic side effects to emerge and the drug to be abandoned. Drugs are scrapped as much as 50% of the time, even late in the process. When new chemical agents are developed, not existing drugs that are simply being evaluated for a new use, like dexamethasone, little is known about their safety, toxicity, and pharmacokinetics. The process is even more confusing, and in vitro studies with human cells or with animals are done to try to get a handle on those parameters. This is where the human tendency to altruism and cooperation becomes really helpful. Testing drugs always requires volunteers willing to assume some risk by taking a new and incompletely understood pharmaceutical agent. Ultimately, there must be some first-in-human or first-human dose studies, known as Phase 1 studies. These studies are then followed by Phase 2 studies, which involve slightly larger numbers of subjects and attempt to further explore the safety of the drug and, more important, get an initial sense of its efficacy. If this phase is promising, then Phase 3 studies, involving a much larger number of people in a randomized controlled trial, are initiated with an eye to quantifying the actual efficacy of the drug. In such pivotal Phase 3 studies, one group of people is randomly assigned to get the active agent, and another, the control group, gets either a placebo or whatever constitutes the usual standard of care. During Phase 3, scientists also assess the possible emergence of rare toxicities that could not have been observed in the small Phase 1 and Phase 2 studies. Finally, even after a drug is released, ongoing monitoring is necessary to make sure the pharmaceutical works in a broader, representative sample of people who get it, and to check for even rarer toxicities. This is known as Phase 4. The rates of the outcomes of interest, illness, death, toxicities, and so on, are monitored and compared in the two groups in a Phase 3 study, the treatment group and the control group. In the case of a vaccine trial, this can take as long as a year, while researchers wait for patients to be exposed to and possibly get the disease naturally. If fewer patients in the group that got the vaccine go on to develop the illness than in the group that did not get the vaccine, this provides the evidence needed that the vaccine works to prevent infection. But a problem emerged as COVID-19 vaccine trials got underway. In many parts of the world, such as in China, because of NPIs like mask wearing and work closures, not enough people were getting sick to allow for efficient testing of the vaccines. Since the efficacy of the vaccine is assessed by comparing how many people who got the vaccine contracted COVID-19 compared to how many people who did not get the vaccine contracted it, a low incidence of COVID-19 means that very large numbers of subjects had to be enrolled. If no one gets exposed to the virus naturally, there is no way to test the vaccine. Ironically, success in deploying non-pharmaceutical interventions to control the disease made it harder to assess the efficacy of pharmaceutical interventions. For this reason, and in order to accelerate Phase 3 of a vaccine trial, some scientists propose an alternative to simply waiting for people to get sick with COVID-19 naturally. They could do what Jenner did, and what the 229E coronavirus study did, affirmatively challenge vaccinated people by deliberately infecting them with SARS-2. Of course, giving volunteers the live SARS-2 virus risks disabling or killing them. But accelerating the development of a vaccine could significantly reduce death and disease in the population at large. And the risk to volunteers could be minimized if the volunteers were young and healthy, received excellent care, or were otherwise already at high risk of infection, meaning that they had something to gain and less to lose from participating. For instance, good candidates for such an experiment would be healthcare workers or, conversely, people who were caring for chronically ill relatives and who wanted to avoid getting COVID-19 for fear of transmitting it to their loved ones. Once again, given the altruism in our species, such volunteers emerged. Josh Morrison, who lives in Brooklyn, New York, leads a nonprofit that tries to make kidney donation easier. In 2011, he donated a kidney himself, accepting a small risk of death in order to save the life of a stranger. Helping to accelerate the development of a vaccine for COVID-19 by taking a similar risk, he reasoned, could save thousands of lives. After hearing about the possibility of challenge trials, he established COVID Challenge, a hub for people to volunteer and to advocate for safe and rapid vaccine development. Over 1,550 people signed up by April 2020. Journalist Connor Friedersdorf interviewed some of them. One of them was Gabrielle Kleinwachs, a 23-year-old studying mechanical engineering at the University of Colorado at Boulder. As a Jew, she had always been moved by the Talmudic saying, "He who saves a life saves the world entire." And so she said, "I'm lucky in a lot of ways, including good health. I'm young. I don't get sick a lot. This seems like a way that I can share some of that luck. I empathize with other people. The pain of losing someone you care about is the same, no matter who you are. Anything to reduce that amount of pain is something I should try to do." Furthermore, she continued, "there's the risk of participating in a human trial, but there's also the risk of just walking around. It's not that I'm not afraid of the virus. I am. But the trial didn't seem like an enormous added risk." Another volunteer, Mabel Rosenheck, a 35-year-old historian at Temple University in Philadelphia, explained her motivations as follows. "The risks that other people are taking on are so much bigger in terms of doctors and nurses, grocery store workers, people who are out there every day. The risk that I could take would be comparable, but not even as strong, because I would have good medical care and people watching over me right from the start." Still more cooperation is required beyond what is needed to develop and test the pharmaceutical interventions. People still need to actually get the vaccine for their own and everyone else's benefit. Evidence emerged in May 2020 that the percentage of individuals who said they would likely get a hypothetical vaccine declined in parallel with waning fear of the pathogen at that time. Given the misinformation about vaccine risks, the baseline anti-vax movement, and, perhaps most important, the political polarization that has unfortunately come to characterize many aspects of our collective response to the COVID-19 pandemic, it could require significant effort to persuade everyone to get the vaccine. For a vaccine to work on a collective level and confer herd immunity, people would have to once again cooperate. As we saw before, given the R-naught of SARS-2, roughly 67% of the population needs to be immunized. One poll in early May indicated that 72% of Americans would get a vaccine if one were available. The willingness varied by race. 74% of whites were willing, compared to 54% of blacks, despite the greater burden of the disease in black people. This perhaps reflects the shameful legacy of racist medical experimentation in our country that has left a residue of suspicion of the medical establishment in some African Americans. Political affiliation also seemed to play a role, and 79% of Democrats expressed willingness to be vaccinated, compared with 65% of Republicans. However, another national poll, conducted in May 2020, found that, among those planning to receive a vaccine when it became available, 93% said they would do it to protect themselves. Nearly as many, 88%, said they would do it to protect their families. And 78% said they would get a vaccine because, "I want to protect my community." Such pro-social motivations are ever present. As we discussed in Chapter 4, epidemics foster fear and anxiety. These psychological states, like the germs themselves, spread from person to person. But good ideas also spread from person to person. Even though the pathogen is exploiting our species' evolved and quite natural tendency to gather in groups, there are other parts of our evolved sociability that the pathogen does not change. We evolved one of the great mysteries of evolutionary biology, the capacity to make sacrifices for each other, to cooperate, and to teach each other. Darwin himself was perplexed by how it could be that such altruism arose, evolutionarily speaking. How could selfish creatures make sacrifices to help others? And yet humans do this all the time. These capacities for altruism, cooperation, and teaching, which are so fundamental to us, are ones that the virus does not destroy. And it is these capacities that will allow us to confront it. Even as we maintain physical distance, we can still band together to fight the virus. In the 1990s, during the HIV pandemic, about one-third of the hospice patients in Chicago where I worked were dying, brutally, of AIDS. A further third were dying of cancer, and the final third were dying of all remaining conditions combined. The AIDS patients were mostly young men. It was awful to witness their deaths. The first effective drug against the condition, azithromycin, or AZT, had been released in 1987, but the disease was generally still a death sentence. AIDS activists, such as Larry Kramer, the American playwright who founded ACT UP, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, and who died at age 84 on May 27, 2020, vigorously pressured the government to do more, to support more research, to take the disease more seriously. Among his targets was Dr. Anthony Fauci, who was already leading NIAID at the time and who was frequently made aware of Kramer's frustration. At the activist's death, Fauci was quoted as saying, "It was an extraordinary 33-year relationship. We loved each other." Famously, as part of their Storm the NIH campaign, ACT UP organized a march by hundreds of protesters to the bucolic campus of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, on May 21, 1990. Carrying signs reading, "Red tape kills us," and chanting, "NIH, you can't hide, we charge you with genocide," they were met by 200 riot police on horseback. But they succeeded in changing the agenda for drug development. In 1995, after much effort, a drug known as saquinavir, a protease inhibitor, was discovered. It became part of a three-drug regimen composed of saquinavir, didioxycytidine, DDC, and AZT, a combination called Highly Active Antiretroviral Therapy, or HART. In 1996, results from two pivotal randomized controlled trials involving a total of over 1,200 volunteers and supported by NIAID showed that HART was extremely effective. Though the side effects were considerable and the daily dosing regimens very complex, it was life-saving. With HART, many patients saw the viral load of HIV in their blood become undetectable. And over the course of just a few months in early 1997, our hospice program virtually stopped having to care for any HIV patients. Just like that. HART converted a disease that was uniformly fatal into one that could be managed for a very long time, almost like any other chronic illness. It was incredible. Following the success of HART, in 2003, President George W. Bush launched PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, the largest international single-disease initiative in history. It is credited with saving many millions of lives, mainly in sub-Saharan Africa. All this is what cooperation and teaching were able to accomplish. And this is how, in the end, we will defeat the virus. By connecting, volunteering, and learning, we can affirmatively work together to outlast the predations and limit the damage of such a tiny thing. Chapter 7. Things Change. In Monza, he happened to pass a shop which was open and had bread set out for sale. He asked for 2 loaves so that he would not have to go hungry later on, whatever might happen. The baker signed to him not to come in and held out a small dish filled with water and vinegar on the blade of a shovel, telling him to drop the money in there. Then he passed the 2 loaves over to Renzo, one after the other, with a pair of tongs. Alessandro Manzoni, The Betrothed, 1827. In March 2020, as the lockdowns were coming into force in Europe, seismologist Thomas Lecoq of the Royal Observatory of Belgium noticed that the Earth was suddenly still. Every day, as we humans operate our factories, drive our cars, even simply walk on our sidewalks, we rattle the planet. Incredibly, these rattles can be detected as if they were infinitesimal earthquakes. And they had stopped. After Lecoq's initial observation, seismologists around the world began to share data. With the anthropogenic shaking of our planet subdued, they could even detect the rushing of rivers far away. The unexpected calm allowed them to use naturally occurring background vibrations, such as the crashing of distant ocean waves, to better understand the deformation of the Earth's stony crust. The coronavirus had changed the way the Earth moved. Other signs pointed to a changing world as well. In the spring of 2020, many videos went viral of wild animals moving into cities. Herds of wild goats, crocodiles, leopards, even elephants wandered streets now devoid of traffic. Satellites high above our planet looked down and detected the disappearance of pollution as manufacturing ceased. In India, where over 1.2 million people die each year as a consequence of air pollution, residents of the city of Jalandhar looked up to see the Dauladhar peaks of the Himalayas over 120 miles away. The mountains appeared in startling relief against incredibly clear blue skies for the first time the older residents could remember since they were little children. While the rest of the natural world began to heal, humans continued to suffer. We reshaped our way of life to slow the spread of the virus. Of course, our non-pharmaceutical interventions were able to postpone and mitigate the pandemic, not stop it. Once the virus had been established in our species, the outcome of the pandemic was inevitable, almost no matter what we did. There would be many deaths. The epidemiology alone, an R-naught of 3.0 and a CFR of 0.5 to 1.2%, dictated that. In the summer of 2020, I kept trying to push these thoughts from my mind, but I could not think of a sound reason to justify optimism. As I reviewed the graphs showing sudden spikes in caseloads in states like Arizona, Texas, Florida, and California at the end of June, and as I listened to President Trump and Vice President Pence insisting that this escalation was merely a function of too much COVID testing, I felt despair. In talking to my epidemiology colleagues, I detected a similar gloom. In his public pronouncements, Dr. Fauci, though he expressed cautious optimism for the rapid development of a vaccine, was clearly somber. Other concerning signs appeared over the summer as well. We learned that in India, for unclear reasons, younger people died of SARS-2 in higher proportions than in other countries. That country was being hit so hard that it resorted to using railway cars to create 8,000 more beds for COVID-19 patients in the capital. At the same time, the virus reemerged in China and in other populous countries, such as South Korea, that had previously successfully controlled it. In Brazil, whose president Jair Bolsonaro was so dismissive of what he called a little flu that a federal judge had to order him to wear a mask, the virus ran loose. In fact, like Boris Johnson in England before him, Bolsonaro became infected himself. Very preliminary hints also emerged from genetics laboratories around the world that the virus might possibly have certain variants that were worse for humans, more deadly or more infectious, or both. And with the passage of time, information began to accumulate about the long-term morbidity associated with the virus. Some patients would be debilitated for months after recovery. In other words, for all we have learned about the virus through the early stages of the pandemic, there is still colossal uncertainty about exactly how it will continue to change the shape of our society in the coming years. Nevertheless, it's quite clear that the virus has already changed our world and that it will continue to do so for some time. Let's first establish a time frame. If we are able to make a safe and effective vaccine, distribute it rapidly and widely, and get large numbers of people to take it, we might shorten the duration of the pandemic. But even if we are able to clear all of the hurdles for such a rollout, the vaccine still might not arrive before we achieve herd immunity. That is, since we are likely to reach an attack rate of roughly 40 to 50% by 2022, no matter what we do, unless the vaccine becomes widely available in early 2021, which would be the fastest a vaccine has ever been developed by far, it will not make much of a difference in the overall course of the pandemic, though even then the vaccine would still be enormously valuable to protect uninfected people. Either way, until 2022, Americans will live in an acutely changed world. They will be wearing masks, for example, and avoiding crowded places. I'll call this the immediate pandemic period. For a few years after we either reach herd immunity or have a widely distributed vaccine, people will still be recovering from the overall clinical, psychological, social, and economic shock of the pandemic and the adjustments it required, perhaps through 2024. I'll call this the intermediate pandemic period. Then, gradually, things will return to normal, albeit in a world with some persistent changes. Around 2024, the post-pandemic period will likely begin. We cannot anticipate all the ways our lives will change, and in 50 years, we may not even remember which changes the pandemic catalyzed. For example, spittoons and public spitting were widespread in the United States up to the beginning of the 20th century. But they were both abandoned in part because of the 1918 influenza pandemic, when they were rightly seen as unsanitary. For a more recent example, I was well into adulthood before it became obvious to the world that flying in an enclosed space or waiting in a hospital for a medical procedure were not opportune moments to light up a cigarette. In hindsight, these unneighborly practices seem ridiculous. We do not go into restaurants and wonder why there are no spittoons, and the no smoking signs on airplanes feel like an abstract formality. We have forgotten how the world used to be. Many personal attitudes and practices, at home and at work, have had to change due to the pandemic. The deadly virus on the loose, the isolation, and the slowed economy all work together to foster more self-reliance. We have already seen this with respect to personal responsibility for some of the non-pharmaceutical interventions. But many other activities also called for greater independence, from home cooking to home haircuts to the performance of minor home repairs. Why risk having a plumber come over if he might have the virus? Why spend the money if you are out of work? People also took more personal responsibility for their medical care and were obliged to make more careful judgments about whether to seek professional treatment given the risks of going to a healthcare facility. Children may have benefited the most from the increased independence. In contrast to the pre-pandemic helicopter parenting culture that kept so many young people from acquiring autonomy, a lot of parents seem to have waved the white flag after a few weeks of homeschooling, abandoning any pretense of adult control. Teenagers assumed vampire hours, forgoing family dinners, and wolfing down a couple of frozen burritos late at night after a hard day's shut-eye. One father reported that he felt like a criminal investigator every morning. "I'll find the wrappers from some snacks that my son had. There will be dishes in the sink from what he ate. Sometimes he'll leave the TV on to what he was watching. It's like having a raccoon that came through my house in the night." Odd eating patterns aside, many children and parents reported that children were spending much more meaningful time with family, as well as more time playing outdoors or unsupervised. Lenore Skenazy, an advocate for independence among children, ran an independence challenge essay contest in the spring of 2020, and some of the responses illustrated the ways in which children thrived with less supervision. One 8-year-old girl gleefully reported that she rode her bicycle farther and faster than she was allowed. A 10-year-old enjoyed the independence of doing the laundry. A 7-year-old, who had previously been afraid of the stove, started cooking his own eggs. The budding chef said proudly, "I'm getting independent in cooking. I can make omelet, veggie, and plain. Hardest part is cracking the egg right over the pan, because you can get burned the first time you do it." Around the country, people started baking from scratch or growing food to reduce expenses and unnecessary shopping trips. One 86-year-old woman in my community began growing a garden for the first time in her life. She painstakingly carried soil to her plant beds, one bucket at a time. "I'm not only prepping my garden, but also prepping my body," she said, anticipating the possibility of falling ill with a virus. For some families, home gardening was part of homeschooling. For others, it was a way for them to contribute. They gave the food they grew to local food pantries or to their neighbors in a palpable manifestation of the kind of neighborly cooperation we saw before. Another change was how much time we spent at home. Millions of people began working from home, adjusting the rhythm of their lives and the allocation of space. Millions of others were at home due to unemployment, and the pandemic greatly amplified the challenges of those without homes, too. Some of the advantages of urban life, the interconnected webs of cultural offerings, workspaces, coffee shops, public transportation, began to look like liabilities. People withdrew from public spaces, and there was some exodus from major cities to surrounding suburbs and rural areas, as we have seen. In some ways, these new modes of living hark back to the past. For many centuries, a greater percentage of humans lived outside of cities than in them. As late as 1950, only 29.5% of the world's population lived in cities, and the percentage was 55.5% even for the developed world. In 2018, those numbers stood at 60.4% and 81.4% respectively. For thousands of years, most people lived on farms and more independently took care of their own affairs. In 2020, many households returned to some features of this model, taking care of their own families in their own homes. In heterosexual relationships, there was evidence that, while the demands of homeschooling primarily fell to women, other household obligations came to be divided more equitably between men and women. On average, men increased the percentage of childcare and housework they did. And in these new living arrangements, people were much more likely to spend time with kin than with strangers or even with nearby friends. Of course, our nation did not entirely return to a 19th century lifestyle in 2020. But this localized, familial way of living was not so unusual for our species. Of course, even when humans lived in a more agrarian way, plagues still occurred, fueled by the densely packed cities where conditions were far worse than those in cities today. And farm living alone does not protect people from plagues. In some ways, this again reminds us that the virus is very effective in exploiting features of how humans live, albeit especially how they have lived since the agricultural revolution. Neither farms nor cities were features of our more distant evolutionary past, prior to approximately 10,000 years ago. They arose as humans abandoned a hunter-gatherer way of life, which, with much smaller groups of people and more limited interactions between them, was much less prone to explosive pandemics. Yet there's a wrinkle in this line of thinking that offers hope for our modern metropolises. Some of the most densely populated places on Earth, Asian cities, have, to date, been very successful in containing the coronavirus pandemic. As we saw before, this paradox illustrates another important feature of our evolutionary heritage, the human capacity for cultural innovation and learning. Modern living environments may incubate more germs, but they can also incubate more ways to combat them. Despite our plentiful supply of clean water, Americans are surprisingly germy people. In one commercial survey of hygiene practices in 8 countries, only Germans were worse hand washers. Perhaps study participants in countries like India are more familiar with the devastating burden of infection. But lack of knowledge is not the primary problem. Another survey conducted for the American Microbiology Society found big gaps between Americans' professed and observed hand washing practices. The researchers actually monitored behavior in public restrooms. In other words, Americans know they should wash their hands. They just do not translate that knowledge into action. This is particularly true for men. A quantitative assessment of 85 scientific studies found that compared to men, women were better hand washers, and they were 50% more likely to implement NPIs on all fronts, including masking. Hand washing is a special concern because our social custom of handshaking provides a mode of disease spread. While some pandemic lifestyle changes were hard for many Americans to adopt, This long-held habit of reaching for a person's hand disappeared overnight early in the pandemic, even before people began to stay 6 feet apart. Officials were quick to acknowledge the importance of giving up handshaking. Dr. Fauci declared that post-pandemic America would involve compulsive hand-washing and the end of handshaking. Dr. Gregory Polland, director of the Mayo Clinic Vaccine Research Group, called handshaking an outdated custom and pointed out that many cultures have learned that we can greet one another without touching each other. While the origins of handshaking are unclear, the greeting has been around for thousands of years. Some theorize that a clasping of empty, and therefore weaponless, right hands originally expressed peaceful intent or symbolized a sacred oath, and that the shaking action verified that both parties had no weapons hidden up their sleeves. Whatever the origin, the practice is ancient. One of the earliest recorded handshakes is depicted in a 9th century BCE stone relief, showing Assyria's king Shalmaneser III clasping palms with a Babylonian ruler. Mentions of handshaking appear throughout ancient art and literature, from Homer's epics to engravings on Roman coins. The tradition may also be rooted in human evolution, playing a role in social chemosignaling. As one investigator noted, human overt olfactory sampling and investigation of unfamiliar individuals is largely a taboo, meaning that people do not explicitly approach strangers and sniff them. But handshaking may be a mechanism to sample the odors of other people. This possibility is supported by experiments that show that people sniff their right hands more after shaking hands with a stranger of their own gender, as if to evaluate them. And chimpanzees will sometimes link hands, by their palms or wrists, depending on group membership, with their grooming partners and raise them upward, using their free hands to groom. Group-specific handshakes in chimpanzees are intergenerational, passed down from mother to offspring, perhaps constituting a form of cultural learning. Even animals that do not have hands have evolved displays of friendly greeting. An aggressive dog will have an upright posture with a rigid tail, a flexed body, and a forward-facing head. But a friendly dog will get low to the ground, crouch, look upward, and wag its tail. Charles Darwin accounted for this by what he calls the principle of antithesis, which refers to emotional displays that are the opposite of displays that evolve to serve another purpose. In humans, too, friendly displays are the opposite of aggressive ones. We open our hands rather than clench them. We approach other people closely rather than keeping a wary distance, and we expose vulnerable parts of our bodies, such as our faces. Of course, the precise means by which we do this varies from culture to culture, but all cultures have conventions regarding which sorts of greetings are friendly and which are threatening. Thankfully, handshake-heavy cultures were able to abandon this tendency with relative ease because humans are an intelligent species capable of quick learning when another evolutionary pressure, survival during an infectious outbreak, demands it. While the pandemic forced people worldwide to forgo more intimate greetings like handshaking, kissing, hugging, and the Maori hongi, a traditional greeting involving pressing together of noses, many of the world's cultures had been practicing no-contact greetings for quite some time. For instance, namaste, a greeting usually accompanied by the Anjali Mudra gesture, which involves pressing one's palms together with hands pointing upward and thumbs against the chest, is several thousand years old. It was written about in the Rig Veda, a Hindu religious text. The Y, involving a bow of the head and pressed hands in front of the chest, is widely used in Thailand. Mulibwanji, hello, said together with a clapping of cupped hands, is a common practice in Zambia. In Japan, bowing as a greeting was first introduced via China in the 7th century. The bow was originally a practice of the noble class, but it became popular among samurai warriors during the 12th century and eventually reached the commoners after the Edo period, approximately 5 centuries later. Bowing had a chance to catch on in America, as it was practiced in Puritan communities during colonial times, generally as an obeisance, inferiors bow to their superiors, men bow to women. But during the Revolutionary War period, some considered bowing undemocratic, and handshaking rose in popularity. Similarly, handshaking was popularized by 17th and 18th century Quakers in order to replace more hierarchical greetings. The COVID-19 pandemic is not the first time that health professionals have recommended against handshaking. In 1929, nurse Layla Given observed that hands are agents of bacterial transfer and suggested that Americans adopt an alternative form of greeting. Even earlier, following the 1793 yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia, the old custom of shaking hands fell into such general disuse that many shrank back with affright at even the offer of the hand. Although the custom was clearly never extinguished in the United States, the avoidance of handshaking is much more widespread now and more broadly described by authorities as a proper means of infection control. Like so many other personal behaviors, our greetings reflect our biology, history, and culture. But a deadly pandemic can reshape them. One of the ironies at the start of the pandemic was that people either had too much privacy or too little. In some ways, intimacy increased because people were staying home with their families. But in other ways, intimacy decreased, and not just because people avoided body contact during greetings. For instance, wearing masks can be anonymizing, and many Americans began to die far from their loved ones, among strangers. Those changes in privacy would be familiar to survivors of past plagues, but the COVID-19 pandemic also heightened fundamental concerns about norms of privacy that are intertwined with 21st century developments in technology. Technologies of mass surveillance were already growing in sophistication and ubiquity, but in the spring of 2020, they found a new deployment when over 1 million students were monitored while taking exams. Many millions of university students were sent home suddenly at the beginning of March, and universities made a quick switch to online learning. At the University of Washington in Seattle, a message went out on the afternoon of Friday, March 6, 2020, that all classes for more than 40,000 students would shift online by that Monday. Students around the country who went home to continue their schooling at a distance had to take exams while being remotely monitored by employees of commercial proctoring firms, strangers who observed their every move, monitored their faces, listened in on the conversations in their homes, and demanded that the students point the camera in different directions so they could make sure nothing was amiss. The students could not see the proctors' faces, however. This led to some uncomfortable test-taking situations. For instance, while taking an exam in her bedroom, Cheyenne Keating, a sophomore at the University of Florida, felt she needed to vomit, but bathroom breaks were not allowed. She looked into the camera on her computer and asked the person who was proctoring her test if it was okay for her to throw up at her desk. After the proctor said yes, she vomited into a nearby wicker basket and then cleaned up as best she could using a blanket within reach. Automated computational methods were brought to bear to predict cheating. If the student looked off-screen for more than 4 seconds, more than twice in a minute, this was deemed suspect. To make sure that the student did not switch with a different person to take a test, the software used facial recognition capabilities linked to ID cards. Even the cadence of the student's typing could be monitored and compared to a baseline that was distinctive for each person. The proctoring companies retained rights to all the audio and video they captured, as well as to other private information about the students, leading some professors to decry these methods as a move to turn their universities into surveillance tools. The loss of privacy related to remote learning played out in other ways, too. In one case, a fifth-grade boy who joined a video call with his school had BB guns on a wall behind him, and they were spotted by his teacher. She took a screenshot and notified the police, who then paid an unexpected visit to the family. The officer left after 20 minutes, having concluded that the family was not breaking any laws. The principal said that having a gun, even a BB gun, visible in a virtual classroom was the same as bringing one into a real classroom. Even people who were long past graduation had strangers peering into their rooms in other intimate ways. As professionals around the country were interviewed at home and work groups met online over video conferences, viewers got uncommon opportunities to see into other people's lives. In March 2020, I did a TV interview with Amanpour & Company from my home office. Later, I was contacted by a reporter who was curious about a particular painting by my artist's daughter. She described the contents of my office as well as the home environments of many other experts, including one U.S. senator who did an interview in front of her kitchen refrigerator in an article that appeared in the Los Angeles Times. Part of me was flattered, but a bigger part felt weird. I ended up buying a large piece of fabric emblazoned with a Yale logo to use as a backdrop. Remote monitoring played out on a grander stage, too. Many forms of big data and internet tracking technologies were used to monitor people, to see if they were self-isolating, to detect interactions that placed people at risk of infection, and to follow the response of whole populations. SARS-2 became so prevalent and spread so fast that it proved almost impossible to contain with manual contact tracing, as we saw in Chapter 3. However, a contact tracing app that made the process faster, broader, and more efficient, that automatically kept track of all the people who had been near a sick person and then somehow immediately notified contacts of positive cases, could help achieve epidemic control. Technology experts pointed out that contact tracing apps with access to intimate location data from cell phones would be especially useful to governments in the case of SARS-2 because of its capacity for asymptomatic transmission, but only if enough people use the apps. This would require persuading or ordering a very large fraction of the population to permit the government to have access to phone records. Those in favor of implementing such widespread and automatic systems noted that many people might willingly surrender some of their privacy so as to acquire more freedom. They argued that citizens might prefer being tracked by the government when they left home to the alternative of being ordered by the government to stay home. Governments around the world, including in China, Singapore, and Israel, implemented various techniques to exploit such data, as did various European consortia of NGOs and companies. Apple and Google worked together to enable technology that would make contact tracing with cell phones possible on an opt-in basis, although their solution has been met with pushback from some states. In Russia and China, such technology was supplemented by a broad network of cameras equipped with facial recognition software that was also used in containment efforts. In South Korea, investigators combined multiple sources of information, including location data from smartphones, security camera footage, and financial records from credit card companies, indicating where and when people had been in stores to do contact tracing. Many Americans also seemed willing to make such sacrifices of their privacy as well. Some even argued that the government should be allowed to monitor smartphone data, including Bluetooth and GPS signals. The COVID-19 pandemic thus reignited debates about the balance between privacy and civil liberties that had arisen in the wake of the terrorist attacks of 9/11. In practice, however, these apps do not offer enough epidemiological benefit to justify the privacy trade-off. Cell phone-based contact tracing apps might not be that effective because GPS signals are not precise enough to indicate whether people have been within 6 feet of each other. Bluetooth signals can cut through walls and so might falsely indicate that people were close to each other when they were not. Huge amounts of time might be wasted on false leads. But even if the apps worked, there could be issues. I was reminded of Benjamin Franklin's adage, which he articulated in a rather different context, that those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. The erosion of liberty weakens a democracy. Partly in order to address these concerns, my team in the Human Nature Lab released an app called Hunala in late May 2020. The app respects user privacy, is voluntary, and provides a useful tool for people to manage risk. Unlike most contact tracing apps, which are retrospective and indicate to subjects whether they have previously been in contact with someone who was infected, Our app is prospective, forecasting the user's risk of coming into contact with someone who has the virus. It works like a traffic app that collects data from many people about the location of traffic jams and then aggregates it to give anonymized information to other nearby users. Our app maps social networks of individuals based on information they provide and invites people to report their symptoms as often as they wish. It then uses computational algorithms to notify people that their risk of contracting a respiratory disease is elevated because, for instance, 20 days earlier, their friends' friends' friends, who are strangers to them, reported that they had fevers. With a network of connections, it's possible to predict the chances that the virus could spread to them across a sequence of contacts. No information about particular individuals is shared, just like a traffic app does not inform people who exactly has been stopped by the police on a highway. But being notified of elevated personal risk allows a person to take precautionary action, such as staying at home, the same way a driver might exit the highway when alerted that traffic is at a standstill a few miles ahead. Pandemics can impinge on other deeply personal matters. During historical plagues, religious fervor often increased as a means to cope with the seemingly indiscriminate deaths. Appeals to deities, whether out of fear or respect, were understandable responses to catastrophe that seemed to lack a worldly explanation. However, especially when the plague involved a very high death toll, religious disillusionment was also common. How could a caring God cause or even allow such a calamity? Would belief even make a difference? During the plague of Athens in 430 BCE, Thucydides observed that for his fellow citizens, fear of gods did not restrain them. They judged it to be just the same, whether they worshipped the gods or not, as they saw all alike perishing. In the immediate pandemic period, COVID-19 has affected personal religious behavior, particularly among highly religious people. For instance, in one representative national survey conducted in the spring of 2020, 55% of adults reported having prayed for an end to the spread of the virus, including 73% of Christians and 86% of people who ordinarily prayed daily. The less religious became somewhat more religious. 15% of people who seldom or never prayed and 24% of those without a religious affiliation also prayed for an end to the pandemic. Another poll found that while 78% of people reported that their personal faith or spirituality had remained unchanged during the pandemic, more people reported that their faith or spirituality had gotten better, 20%, than those who said it had gotten worse, 3%. Still another poll conducted in late April showed that 24% of U.S. adults said that their faith had grown stronger because of the coronavirus, while only 2% said that it had weakened. Women and ethnic and racial minorities were relatively more likely to have increased faith. Despite the net rise in religious sentiment, in-person religious attendance was generally prohibited in the early months of the pandemic, as many churches, synagogues, mosques, and temples across the country shifted to online services. Places of worship posed special risks for the transmission of SARS-2 compared to other indoor locations, such as restaurants and stores, because people tended to be in closer proximity for longer periods, often singing with loud voices, which further enhanced the risk of transmission of the virus. Churches resemble bars and nightclubs in these regards. Many large outbreaks around the world involved religious groups or services, including a major outbreak in a Christian group in Korea in February 2020, several outbreaks in the United States, such as the deadly one involving a church choir in March that we discussed in Chapter 2, and an outbreak of more than 100 cases in people who attended a religious service in Frankfurt, Germany in May. By late April, 91% of adults who reported attending religious services at least monthly in 2019 said that their congregation had closed public religious services, usually in parallel with live streaming the proceedings. Overall, 40% of regular churchgoers substituted virtual worship for in-person services. For many people, the virtual alternatives were just not the same. So some religious leaders adopted imaginative solutions to physical distancing conditions, such as drive-in sermons in church parking lots or at drive-in theaters. Dozens of churches employed this strategy on Easter Sunday, April 12, 2020. That same week, a photo went viral of a priest in a clerical collar conducting an infant baptism by water pistol from 6 feet away. In May, several mosques held drive-through Eid events with live music and gift bags for children. Although virtual services were a disappointment to some worshipers, others saw them as an opportunity for spiritual growth. The Reverend Dr. Guy J.D. Collins, in a pastoral letter to the Episcopal Congregation of St. Thomas Church in Hanover, New Hampshire, described a theology of technology, linking the online worship services adopted in 2020 to a centuries-old tradition of spreading the Word of God via technological innovations, many of which, such as the printing press, were considered heretical in their time. Technology can be a barrier to worship, he noted. However, it is more frequently a channel of grace. Visual technologies have, in particular, been essential to passing down the story of Christian faith when literacy was low and when few comprehended the official Latin language of medieval worship. As the bans on public gatherings were lifted in the late spring of 2020, a dizzying array of rules were imposed across states. In Texas, alternate pews had to be blocked off. From a public health point of view, this makes little sense because people in the same pew could still be closer together, and even alternate pews could still be closer than 6 feet apart. In Massachusetts, masks were required in places of worship. And in New York, services had to be limited to fewer than 10 people. By May, the decision regarding whether places of worship could have in-person services had unfortunately become a political battleground. There were competing claims to, on the one hand, constitutional protection for religious liberty and the right to assemble, and, on the other hand, the guarantee that the government would promote the general welfare as promised in the preamble to the Constitution. In California, several churches took Governor Newsom to court over his stay-at-home orders, arguing that they violated religious freedom, but a federal appeals court allowed his order to stand. The Supreme Court eventually agreed with the appeals court, ruling that as long as government public health policies did not single out churches for special restrictions or benefits, the restrictions did not violate the First Amendment. Regardless of religious belief, many people, whether prompted by thoughts of mortality or by the homebound solitude, were introspective about what gave their lives meaning. I think this opportunity for personal reflection was another factor that played an important role in the massive protests for social justice that took place in June 2020. The pandemic also led people to reevaluate their social interactions, in many cases fostering more empathy and awareness of others. Stories emerged, for instance, of the bitterest of ex-spouses finding a way to communicate more humanely, even compassionately, in arranging the care of their children. As we saw in Chapter 6, disasters can bring out both the worst and the best in people, uniting them against a common enemy. I detected a heightened sense of morality animating people's lives as they stopped to consider their own values and more closely examine how to spend their limited time on Earth. COVID-19 prompted changes in long-standing modes of healthcare practice in the immediate pandemic period, and many of these changes are very likely to last into the post-pandemic period. As we have seen, caring for people with a clinical disease itself affected treatment, including end-of-life care. And large numbers of patients with COVID-19 will suffer long-term effects such as pulmonary, renal, cardiac, or neurological damage. That will lead to a bump in disability in the succeeding years, similar to what was seen after the polio and, as we will discuss later, 1918 flu pandemics. For this reason, hospital systems are preparing to care for large numbers of patients in newly established post-COVID clinics. But so many of the usual ways of doing business in medicine were suspended during the pandemic, to no ill effect, that it is easy to wonder why we did business in the old way at all. For instance, in Chapter 6, we saw some of the ways that vaccine development has been accelerated for COVID-19, with companies rapidly conducting early trials or relying on widespread sharing of genetic sequence information. But there are others. Even though I no longer see patients, for years I have maintained two medical licenses in Connecticut and Massachusetts. Due to the urgent need for doctors during the pandemic, rules about cross-state licensure were relaxed so that I could have practiced in either state with a license from any state. The superfluous patchwork of state laws regarding medical licensure is likely to change after the pandemic recedes. It's a historical relic from a time when medical training was less standardized and some states were less vigilant in managing quacks. Other rules and procedures were rapidly modified by Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurers, most dramatically regarding reimbursement for face-to-face visits. Policymakers and experts had long advocated to allow medical care to be provided over the phone or the internet, and these practices were suddenly not just permissible, but actively encouraged. A large fraction of medical care was moved online to reduce congestion in healthcare facilities. Obstetricians provided routine visits for normal pregnancies over the phone. Dermatologists diagnosed simple skin problems by having patients show them video or photographs. My brother, Dr. Kuan Yang Du, an endocrinologist,